Thanks, Brian, and thanks for the opportunity to talk. As it turns out, I'm going to pick up on some of the themes that have been in all three portions of the symposium and hopefully help feed some more discussion. I'm talking about reevaluating the role of a minor nutrient productivity in the composition of northern hardwood forests. And if you do a search with your favorite search engine on calcium and you put in quotes minor nutrient or secondary nutrient, you get a ton of stuff. And you can pretty well convince yourself that people think that calcium is pretty boring as a nutrient. Here's an example of a lecture I found from Texas A&M posted online saying calcium and magnesium are considered to be secondary fertilizer nutrients. They're often adequate in soils. So, yeah, they're nutrients, but plants don't need that much. And here's a graphic example of that, a saxifrage growing in a calcium-rich site in the Adirondacks that is actually experiencing so much calcium that it has to exude it as calcium carbonate crystals on the edges of the leaves. So calcium is a required nutrient, but plants don't need that much, and they have to work to get rid of it sometimes if they've got too much. Well, over the years, I've been involved in a number of different studies, some observational and some experimental, looking at sugar maple. And I've come to think of sugar maple as being, I've kind of wondered how to term this over the years, but maybe a calcium responsive or a calcium demanding species. It certainly grows on a lot of sites where there's not much calcium and does fine. But there's a growing body of evidence to suggest that it is very strongly dependent on calcium supply, and I'm going to try to review some of those today and raise some questions about where this may be headed in the future. So a lot of this, with my history in it, started with a team that was put together by the Northern Research Station back in the mid-90s to investigate sugar maple decline. At that point, there was a lot of excess mortality of sugar maple in Pennsylvania and southwestern New York, and we put together a team to investigate this. We did some literature review and found that sugar maple decline had first been documented in 1913, and there was an increasing amount of decline episodes dominated since the 1960s throughout the range of the species. And thinking about what this looks like, sugar maple decline is characterized by a reduction in growth, both shoot growth and diamond growth of the stems. Premature fall coloration shows up in parts of the canopy midsummer, unusual levels of twig and branch dieback, and typically individual trees within stands show these symptoms while other nearby trees are seemingly healthy. So this sugar maple decline disease follows a decline disease sort of syndrome as defined by Mannion as an interaction of multiple causal factors, both abiotic and biotic factors, characterized by a gradual deterioration of trees, often ending in unexplained mortality, and often poorly understood and rarely well studied. So we had a chance to study a decline episode in Pennsylvania, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. And based on the work that we did in Pennsylvania and literature review of other decline studies, we put together this model of causes of sugar maple decline as sort of a three-stage model, with the first stage being a predisposing imbalance of nutrition. And so here we can see a number of sites that we studied in Pennsylvania and New York, and they're arranged by four site types. We have boring glaciated soils on the right and the more interesting unglaciated soils on the left, and then classified by landscape position, upper slope or lower slope position. And the decline in Pennsylvania was limited to the upper slope unglaciated site types. And if you look at the foliar chemistry of the sugar maple on these sites compared to the other sites where it remained healthy, we see no difference in NP and K, but the calcium and magnesium are significantly lower on these sites susceptible to the decline, whereas the manganese is quite a bit higher. And this is typical of the decline episodes that have been looked at in the literature. Some of them focus more on calcium, some on more on magnesium, some more on manganese, and these things are often correlated with each other, so they're difficult to pick apart. But these metal nutrients are a common theme in sugar maple decline literature. So once we've got this predisposing factor, inciting factors are actually what seems to tip the balance and cause a sugar maple to have an exaggerated response to secondary stressors such as defoliating insects, drought, and unusual weather events such as soil freezing and winter injury. And then the final hammer that causes the mortality and tips the balance toward the full-fledged decline syndrome is usually some kind of further biologic agent. And a lot of the work we've done, our malaria root rot was very important in the final mortality of the sugar maple. Other investigators have looked at borers and viral infections. So here's a graph that summarizes what we found on the Allegheny Plateau. So we have foliar magnesium on the x-axis, a percent standing dead basal area on the y-axis, and we see a threshold in magnesium shown here of about 0.07% or 700 ppm magnesium. And the declining stands all had foliar magnesium below this threshold and all had a severe defoliation history defined as two or more moderate to severe defoliations in the preceding decade. In contrast, some of these stands over here that had not had the defoliation pressure, or regardless of the defoliation pressure, are healthy, and some of these red dots over here actually had six or seven defoliation events in the decade prior to our study during this decline episode and remained healthy. So it was the combination of the poor nutrition and the excessive defoliation stress that seemed to be what was causing the sugar maple decline here in Pennsylvania. So from this work with looking at thresholds with foliar chemistry in Pennsylvania and looking at other foliar studies that have been done in other areas of sugar maple, we proposed a number of thresholds for susceptibility to decline disease. When magnesium is less than 700 milligrams per kilogram, calcium less than 5,500, manganese greater than 1900, this is where we would see stands that are susceptible to decline if an additional stressor were to come along and start this syndrome. And often stands either fall above or below these thresholds for all three elements, so it can be difficult to tease apart the effects of one or the other. So what about growth? I mean, mortality is a pretty final thing. Do we see similar impacts just with growth in seemingly healthy stands? So here's a number of healthy stands that we looked at across the region. We expanded the observational studies into Vermont and New Hampshire. And if you look at annual basal area increment from the 1930s to the recent times for two subregions, New Hampshire and Vermont shown in black, the open circles, Pennsylvania, New York, you can see that growth seems to be generally increasing over time. You don't really see any differences over time or between the subregions. But if we break out the stands on whether they are above or below this proposed foliar threshold for calcium, we can see that they grew similarly, Pennsylvania, New York, up until the mid-60s. New Hampshire, Vermont, similar growth up until maybe the early 1970s. And then since that time, there's been a segregation where growth has been better on the more calcium-rich sites than on the base-rich sites, suggesting that something has changed, possibly hinting toward the effects of acid deposition in this area coming into play during the 60s and more recently. We can break that down a little bit further by dividing up the foliar chemistry into six classes here. And looking at the basal area increment on five-year increments, you can see that the lowest class of calcium nutrition had a growth that's basically crashed through the 1960s, whereas to the two higher classes, above about 10,000 parts per million calcium, have increasing basal area increment throughout the period. So I don't think we went this far in the paper, but for the purposes of the discussion today, I'd like to suggest that maybe 10,000 milligrams per kilogram of calcium might provide a number that would suggest that these are sugar maple that are doing as best as they possibly can. And at some of these more intermediate to poorer levels, we see that it's not performing as well as possible. So I'll turn to a couple experimental things that have kind of shown some similar things here. We've been following a liming application that was done in 1985 on glaciated soils in central Pennsylvania. up to the present, and this was done on some plots, a series of five plots on the Susquehannock State Forest, and you can see here's the photochemistry in 2006, about 20 years after the initial fertilization, showing increases in calcium and magnesium, phosphorus, nitrogen, not affected. There's a slight decrease in potassium, suggesting maybe an interference of potassium uptake there. But this is a long-lived treatment that's had effects for a couple of decades at this point. Looking at the response of sugar maple, it took over 8 years for sugar maple growth to be significantly improved by the liming application. So a lot of studies that have not reported responses to these kinds of fertilization treatments, we wonder whether they've looked long enough or not. But from 8 years up to a couple of decades after, sugar maple continues to grow much better on the limed plots versus on the unlimed plots. This is that area that the decline disease came into in the mid-80s. Through the early 90s, you can see similar levels of mortality in the stands. And then as the decline came through, the stands that were limed with the clear bars here had relatively low mortality compared to the unlimed stands. And even other factors such as the percent of crown with flowers, the production of seeds, a number of different responses that showed a positive response to calcium from this liming study. Similarly, up at in Harbor Brook in New Hampshire, where I'm based, we added calcium silicate to a whole watershed in 1999. And there have been a number of responses that have been published since then, also showing a significant improvement of vigor class, crown condition, showing now the paper by Battles et al. Last year showing an increase in annual primary productivity and biomass accumulation, which is reversing declines that have occurred in the reference watershed, a couple watersheds over. And most of this response is with sugar maple in these mixed northern hardwood forests. So we published several years ago this conceptual model influences on sugar maple growth and health, thinking about how these cations are working. So we have calcium and magnesium uptake here, which varies quite a bit over the landscape depending upon the geologic parent material, and then acid deposition, which can both directly reduce the available calcium and magnesium supply with mechanisms such as what the last speaker showed, and then also interfere with uptake through the release of manganese and aluminum, so affecting net photosynthesis and stress response systems, carbohydrate supply, and then ending up affecting the growth and health. So if we think about, well, where are these places where this is likely to be an issue out on the landscape, there's not a lot of information. So I put together a compilation of foliar chemistry, partially from an online database and then from a couple other studies that I've been involved with. I was able to find over 1,000 trees across the region from West Virginia to Maine where there were foliar calcium values, and you can see the cumulative distribution of those data here. So here's the 5,500, this threshold that we've proposed for susceptibility to decline disease. Here's that 10,000 number, maybe a number where growth is as good as it gets, and you can see where some of these experimental areas fall relative to these thresholds. So this suggests that perhaps 40% of the trees in the region, and this is a haphazard sampling, so I have no idea if this relates to 40% of the land area where sugar maple grows, but I think that's an outstanding question. But potentially a large portion of the area could be impacted by these sorts of limitations. So what about nitrogen? So here's a same database that I put together, about 1,100 trees for foliar nitrogen. And if you dig back into the literature, you can find some old nitrogen addition studies looking at response to with sugar maple. And there's a suggestion there that when foliar nitrogen in sugar maple is greater than 2%, that they did not see a growth response. So I've drawn that in as a threshold here, and you can see that some of these experimental treatments that we've done sort of straddle or very close to that point where perhaps nitrogen is no longer limiting the sugar maple, maybe a third of the trees in the area fall beyond that 2% threshold. Here's the relationship of the calcium and nitrogen to each other. No relationship, but it's interesting to think about what portions of the region do these represent, and do we have areas where both nitrogen and calcium are at optimal levels, or maybe not very many, maybe quite a few trees, a large portion of the region where calcium is not in a supply to provide optimal growth. Similarly, a different set of trees where nitrogen may be limiting. So is this maybe set us up to think about some experiments that could be done to look at co-limitation of these elements if we knew how these areas fell out across the landscape. So I want to turn and think about that more from the calcium point of view. And one of the things that we find is that the variation from a very calcium-rich site to a very calcium-poor site often occurs over very short distances. We often find the extremes of what we see in the region over single hill slopes. And this is an example. So here's two plots in Potter County, Pennsylvania from our observational work. Both plots are in ultisols, non-glaciated ultisols formed in the Huntley Mountain sandstone, primarily a quartz-rich lithology. Total soil calcium with a bulk digest, 0.02 to 0.07%. These are basically growing on quartz and kaolinite, very little calcium mineralogy within the rooting zone, but a very strong contrast in the mortality. Hardwood Ridge 1 up on the summit was hit hard by the decline episode. Hardwood Ridge 2 on a mid-side slope position was not hit at all and is a very healthy, productive site. So if we dig down into the soils, we can see that across a couple of hundred meters here with two different landscape positions in a similar soil, same geology, the exchangeable calcium varies by about two orders of magnitude. If we poke around at the rocks in this area, we find a lot of the sandstone rocks have this sort of pitted appearance you see on the rind of this rock here, a lot of holes with staining in them. And this rock actually came out of a road cut that was made just down the road from here fairly recently, so we were able to get into some fresh bedrock that was just impossible to find in natural exposures. So this is a face broken with a hammer, and you can see the lack of the pitting in the interior, and this is actually a weathering rind. And if we look at the thin section of this unweathered interior, the black to the gray is quartz, so it's showing various shades based on its orientation in the polarized light. This pink area that we see in here is calcite, this calcium carbonate acting as a cementing agent. So there is a calcium source at depth, and we've had a little bit of discussion about diffusion and how just do we get these deeper weathering products up into the rooting zone. Well, here's another mechanism. We're seeing these high calcium sites that are very productive for sugar maple, mostly associated with seeps on mid to lower landscape positions. So we think that the very calcium poor soils at the top where hydrologic flow paths are in a downward direction, there's no interaction of the water in the rooting zone with weatherable minerals to release calcium, but that calcium is getting down into the unweathered bedrock and reacting with calcite, resulting in base-rich seeps that are bringing water back up into the rooting zone and maintaining the fertility of these lower landscape positions. So this is thinking about, well, this is not just a geologic phenomenon, but also we've had changes due to acid deposition, and we think that the amount of landscape that falls below these thresholds for calcium for sugar maple has increased because of the depletion. So here we see some soil pits that were dug in 1967 in the black circles compared to 1997, some paired pits, four around each one to try to get at spatial variability issues. And there's about an order of magnitude reduction in exchangeable calcium at these sites here in Pennsylvania over a 30-year period. We had an interesting little exchange with Dale Johnson, who published a discussion on this paper, and he suggested that this amount of depletion of calcium couldn't be explained by acid deposition, and we came up with a couple of things that might be responsible for it. But an interesting one, I think, that hasn't really been considered is the effect of deer and on the understory. And this is an area where the overabundance of deer has been very large in the last couple of decades, and a potential mechanism for recycling and holding the fertility of these sites has basically been eaten and removed. So this is a comparison of the threshold values that we've proposed based on the decline literature, 1967 versus 1997 values of exchangeable calcium as a saturation value on exchange complex, and magnesium as well, so you can see how we've crossed this threshold and during this period when sugar maple decline disease has become prevalent. We're going to just try to speed through a couple more slides here to finish on time, but a major point here is that not all species are created equal, and so here we are back in the regional plots and looking at the sugar maple basal area being higher in recent times on the calcium-rich sites versus the calcium-poor sites. Black cherry does just the opposite. It grows better on the acid sites. See similar things with experimental liming done in Pennsylvania. Here's sugar maple showing enhanced growth, American beets showing no response at all, and black cherry showing a reduction in growth on the lime plots compared to the unlimed plots. If you look into the literature on rich woods and species composition, you can come up with a whole shopping list that I don't expect you to read here, but just the idea that there's a lot of species besides sugar maple that are responsive to calcium and whose presence and abundance and growth is higher on calcium-rich sites versus calcium-poor sites. I've got five tree species here listed in red. A number of other interesting species. I mentioned this deer question. A lot of these species have very high calcium concentrations in their foliage, and in some portions of the region, they're hard to find now because they're preferred food for deer. So what does that do to the fertility of some of these sites over time? There's the idea of a vernal dam. Some of these species are spring ephemerals that come up before the canopy is greens up and may play a critical role. This has been suggested but not well tested. In really getting that nutrients retained on sites and then releasing them later after the tree's overstory is going a little bit later in the spring. And how is that going to be working if the timing of our spring is changing? A number of these species, such as the fragrant fern here, are at the edges of their range, and there's a lot of interesting work in the botanical literature talking about edges of range of species being controlled by calcium concentrations, where the edge of the range, these plants only grow on calcium-rich sites, where in the central parts of their range, they grow on a wide variety of lithologic types. And this idea that calcium is an environmental signal, and species at the edge of the range, where they're maybe not in the climate that, where they work optimally, need to have the extra calcium in order to respond to environmental cues with the weather. So I want to finish up here with a few thoughts that maybe are food for further research. One is that secondary essential nutrients may have primary effects on tree health and growth, and that there may be some evidence for co-limitation or some opportunities here for looking at co-limitation by multiple elements. But I think one of the things that I really want to point out that the other speakers didn't talk on, a lot of other speakers talked about ecosystem response to this, and I'd like to make the point that species matter. So co-occurring species may differ greatly in their nutrient requirements and may respond very different to changes in the environment or to experimental treatments. And then finally, that spatial patterns and nutrient availability are complex and are affected by both native, such as geologic parent material, hydrologic flow paths, native processes, as well as cultural factors such as pollution and past land use. And with that, just a reminder that I worked with a lot of great people with this, and thank you for your attention.
So time for a question or two for Scott.
Hey, Dan.
I was wondering about your ideas about post-logging changes in the forest types.
Well, the pre-settlement forest in a lot of this region was very heavy to beech and hemlock, and there's more sugar maple now than there was for the long time that these soils have developed. So that could be part of the story as well. Good point.
So we have about another 10 or 15 minutes built in for discussion for any of the presenters in this part of the session, or really if you guys want to open it up for discussion further. But we can let Scott off the hook anyway, so thank you, Scott.